song for attorney Brad Young.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Brad and I are going to go hang out next time Metallica's in town.
Brad, you a metal guy?
Oh, hey, that's a banger right there. Love it.
So, attorney Brad Young joins us, as he does every Thursday, going to talk over some cases. Brad, first thing I want you to do, though, is put on your political hat.
Okay.
I'm going to put on my a-hole hat, and we're going to talk...
Also known as a Cubs hat.
We're getting that the president has been diagnosed with some sort of chronic venous insufficiency. And they're saying that it's very common in 70 plus year old people. It's when blood can pool in the legs and he's in no discomfort. It seems to me that I know the Trump playbook pretty well. And this announcement, and he's going to change Coke to real cane sugar, are his, hey, look at this, a shiny thing to get us to stop talking about Epstein. What do you think?
Oh, there's no question about it. In fact, I suspect that the press secretary was actually excited to talk about swollen ankles because that helps change the narrative. Because right now, the narrative in D.C. is MAGA is in a revolt or have a civil war. And it's all over the Epstein stuff, and anything that they can talk about other than Epstein is a win.
So I know that calling things a hoax has been very successful for the president. Again, his playbook to me is not just old, but it's just tattered, and it just doesn't work anymore. But here's what I don't understand. Maybe we can all reason this out together. I don't understand what the hoax is in the Epstein case. Like, okay, I understand all those words, but where's the hoax? Was he not a real person? Did he not abuse children? Did he not take people to his island? Did he not commit suicide? Were you not involved? Like, what is the hoax part of it? I can't even get to whether there is one until I understand what he's even talking about. Do you understand it?
I do. I think the hoax is really focused on two things and two things alone. And that is, number one, that he was murdered while he was in prison. I think that's what's being labeled a hoax. I still think it's a legitimate question. It was a legitimate question when Trump was running for office, and I think it's still a legitimate question. That hasn't changed. And number two is there a list? Because, again, before there was a question about a list. We were told by AG Bondi that there was a list and it was sitting on her desk, and then all of a sudden now it's not. So I think the hoax part of the trying to change the narrative involves, was he murdered or was it a suicide, number one? And number two, is there really a client list?
And the thing about it is, if you just go one more level into thinking, you're making the Democrats seem like geniuses, because if the Democrats are smart enough and resourceful enough and powerful enough to create this hoax and then to convince most of your followers and most of the pundits like Dan Bongino and Kash Patel, I want those people running the country if they're that friggin' smart.
Well, the reality is, and we know this historically, the cover-up is almost always worse than the original crime. That was true with Watergate. That was true with Irangate. That was true with the Clintons, and I forgot what gate that was called. And it's true now, and that is that maybe there is nothing here, but when it looks like you're covering something up, then all that happens is that the sharks start smelling blood in the water. And so the more effort they go to say, there's nothing to see here, the more it looks like a cover-up, which simply spurs people on.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm Trump and I'm not in that file, or I'm in the file, but I only took a couple of rides on his plane and blah, 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 I would have released everything on day one.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because the longer you dodge, the longer you start drinking Coke and start talking about pure cane sugar, it just smacks of a cover-up. These should be getting all of this data out there and let the chips fall where they may. Unless there's a picture of him in there with a goat, I mean, just let it all out.
Yeah, I agree. Let's talk about some cases. The Supreme Court and the Department of Education, flush this one out for us.
Well, real briefly, the Supreme Court issued what's called their emergency docket decision this week. And the whole issue is, can Trump do what's called an RIF, a reduction in force, at the Department of Justice? That was the issue. What's interesting is that the circuit court judge put a stay on it, said he can't do it. But reality is, I think Trump can, but just like with so many things, it dances up to the edge. Here's the bottom line, all you need to know. If he wants to eliminate the Department of Justice, I'm certain that requires congressional approval. But if you want to let people off or increase some hiring, that's within the purview of the executive branch. If you look at the dissenters along ideological lines, they all say Trump's trying to get rid of the Department of Education. Certainly he's trying to, but this move was only letting go about 20 to 25% of the workforce. And that in of itself, I don't believe, constitutes getting rid of the entire department, which would require congressional approval.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting, Brad? It takes you back to law school, because then the question would be, is it a constructive shutting down of the Department of Education if he were to get rid of 80, 90% of the people? But 25% is a deep cut. It's certainly a deep cut if you're among those 25%. But I would tend to agree with you. That's more of a reshaping, not a shutting down.
Right. Now, if he lets go of everybody except Earl the janitor, you know, then we're talking about, it's a different conversation.
Yeah.
But 20 to 25%, I don't think that equates to eliminating the Department of Education.
And the NFL defending itself against charges of monopoly?
Well, this is really interesting, and I'll make it short, but it's very interesting because they were getting sued alleging antitrust violations because of their control of the distribution of licensed merchandise. And so to me, that's always interesting because we all know the NFL is a monopoly. We all know it. They don't have any sort of protection from monopoly status like the Major League Baseball does. We all know they're a monopoly and they keep getting sued for this. But the bottom line is this has already been decided before. The court had, I think it was back in 2010, that the Supreme Court ruled that the NFL does not have to deal with antitrust issues when it comes to merchandising. And so this isn't necessarily a big deal, but it just brings home this idea that this smoke-filled room of a bunch of billionaire men, we know they collude on everything, but they've got good lawyers.
Gotcha. And Tesla defending a case where someone was killed by their autopilot function.
Well, to me, this is the most interesting to banter about because they're being sued. A person was killed. The so-called driver of the Tesla dropped his cell phone. He reached down to get his cell phone. The car zoomed and killed somebody. And so the issue is who's liable? And think about this issue. This is why AI just doesn't fit into our legal system. I mean, how do you identify negligence? Can a computer commit negligence? Do you sue the owner of the car, the manufacturer of the car, the sensor, whoever did the sensors or the software developer? And how do you apply what's called the reasonable person standard, which we all learned in law school, when the reasonable person is a computer driving a car?
Yeah.
I mean, these are just whole issues that our legal system hasn't grappled with yet.
What's your gut?
My gut is that they probably will find Tesla not liable. And of course, you know, they'll probably award him $10 million and then it'll look like a schmuck. But in this instance, the fact that the driver dropped his phone, stuck his head down in the floorboard looking for his phone at the time of the accident, I think that will overshadow any possible liability that Tesla may have.
Gotcha. All right. That's Attorney Brad Young. Brad, you're the best. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Wheels, you're making a face.
On what?
I don't know.
I made a few faces.
Okay.
I think I was just shaking my head at the idea of being the, quote, driver of a car, and you drop something and you're just going to be down on the floorboard looking for it. Like, maybe we should just not do that.
Could be the future, though.
No, I mean,
let's say, for example, that they say it's not the driver. If you're in a car that is autopilot, you have a reasonable expectation that it's going to do the driving and you don't have to pay attention. Let's say that that's either this decision or one in a few years. Then you really could just be, no, you're just a passenger. But I agree with you. I think you've said this before. It has to be one or the other.
It's got to be all or nothing.
Yeah.
It's got to be everybody or nobody.
And having it be all seems like a really long way away.
Because I don't see how an automated car can account for all the variables that come with human beings driving around it, because we do dumb things unexpectedly.
Andrew, did you take a Waymo or you just saw them?
I took one.
Spooky.
And it was spooky and I hated it. And it was super, super Sorry, I thought you said, did you take away Mo? I was like, no, Mo's still here.
He's still running the cards.
No, I really did not care for it. You get in, and it very clearly it tells you, like, don't touch anything, and you can't affect anything, and you're going where you're going, so get used to it. And it's like, honestly, it's very inefficient because they... Because it's not driven by a person, it has to be kind of always going in like a predetermined circle, essentially. Yeah. So anytime you order one, when you order an Uber and it's like, all right, it's 4 minutes away.
Yeah.
Waymos always seem to be like 20 minutes from wherever you are. And due to the nature of it also being driverless, you can't be like, okay... Like when we, I used Grubhub earlier today to get our lunch, and I said, oh, I'm just on this blue awning. So if you just pull up to the blue awning, you see me standing right there. Can't do that with Waymo. So it's like you have to, if the pickup spot that it determines is best for it is 2 blocks from you, well, you're still going to have to walk those 2 blocks to get to it.
Yeah.
And same thing with being dropped off. It can't just very easily, like you would with somebody in an Uber,
over right here.
Yo, right there. See that door right there? Yeah, that's where I'm going in. So just drop me right there. It's not that. It's if it's like, well, the best I can do is 2 blocks away from that door, and you just have to go, okay, sounds good, I guess.
Imagine if one just went crazy. Not even crazy, like running people over, just like took you somewhere you're not supposed to go.
Well, I think that's a very, very big concern for a lot of people. Something I saw a lot when I was in Los Angeles, actually, was... test cars for it. They look absolutely crazy. It looks like a car in like a big suit of armor with like a guy in it, and there's cameras all over it. And after doing some Googling, I found out that those were test cars for self-driving. So that car, it's terrifying because you're going, you're on the freeway or whatever, and you're going 80, and you look over and you're like, oh, that car's not being driven by a person. There's a person in there, but he's not driving. He's just sitting there in case it were to go crazy.
Gotcha. GS on KMOX 221. You have a chance right now to get tickets to see Creed at Thunder Ridge Nature Arena in Ridgedale, Missouri on August 2nd, 2025. That's where Phoebe's going to see Hozier here in a few days. It's supposed to be a beautiful facility. It is Creed at Thunder Ridge Nature Arena on August 2nd, caller number 5 at 314-436-7900 is going to get the tickets. 314-436-7900 to go see Creed. Give Andrew a call now.
Creed's going to call Andrew?
Yes. Staff's on the phone right now.
The bomb on the bed.
They're calling in. Here come the calls.
Here they come. Here come the Creed fans.
We got some Creed fans here,
folks. Here
comes
Crocus to kick your ass. You want to do Throwback Thursday?
I'd love to.
Crocus.
July 17th, back in the day, 108 years ago in 1917, the British royal family's last name was changed from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor.
Didn't know that.
Now we have the Windsors.
Is there anything further? That's interesting.
I did not look further into this. Yes, I apologize.
What was the first name?
Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. It's a mouthful.
It's a lot harder to say. Dumb. Sounds foreign, too.
Let's be the Windsors.
Yeah, that sounds much simpler.
We're making everything else up. Let's just make this up, too.
I mean, they made up the whole royalty thing to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
107 years ago, in 1918, Tsar Nicholas II and the rest of the Russian royal family were executed by revolutionaries called the Bolsheviks. The Romanovs were the last imperial family of Russia and inspired the movie Anastasia.
Yeah, that is an interesting, terrible story.
70 years ago, 1955, Disneyland opened in Anaheim, California. I guess Disneyland was first and then came Disney World, I would assume?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I don't remember when Disney World opened, but I can tell you that so it's 1971 when that opened. I was going to say, I think we were there when I was a kid, maybe in the first few years that it was open.
I was there in 74.
Yeah, 71's when it opened. I think we were probably there 75 or 76.
And I was at Six Flags the first year, I think, too.
Really? Nice.
But it's all bright and shiny.
I believe that was one of Steve Martin's first jobs, was working at the newly opened Disneyland.
Interesting.
Disney World's the same age as me.
Yeah. How does that feel? Yeah. I'm the same age as the Arch.
Oh, that's a cool one.
That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
58 years ago in 1967, Jimi Hendrix dropped out as the opening act for the Monkees because their fans failed to appreciate his musical genius. I guess they had a problem with Jimi Hendrix.
He got booed.
He did, because it's a little bit wild compared to all that bubblegum.
The Monkees were really humiliated by that.
Well,
By what?
By watching him get booed.
Oh, okay.
Well,
okay.
I mean, you're already like barely a band. I know that's rude, but you get what I'm saying. And then it's like you get this genius to come open for you, and your dumb fans are like, this guy sucks.
Were they, I mean, this is a serious question. Were they like the first, what we would think of now as kind of like the boy band?
Like the first created, one I know of.
Like created by TV?
Yeah. No, it was to do the television show.
Right, right.
And they had a casting call. Mickey Dolenz had been a child actor, but didn't play drums. So he had to learn to kind of fake playing drums. The rest of them were legit musicians, but they had like Neil Sedaka and Neil Diamond write all their music for them. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, I really like the Monkees. I'm not trying to be rude when I say they're barely a band.
Too. I'm trying to be rude.
41 years ago in 1984, Ronald Reagan signed the National Minimum Drinking Age Bill that raised the legal drinking age to 21.
Hmm. I don't think it matters.
What do you mean?
So nobody follows it.
Yeah, I just don't think it matters.
Nobody follows it at all.
Maybe it's just having a 20-year-old and everyone has a fake ID. And when we were talking earlier about the UK lowering the voting age to 16, and I said I think that the age for everything should be the same age as when you can be drafted to go fight a foreign war. So if it's 18, you should be able to vote at 18. You should be able to drink at 18. You should be able to get married at 18. Like that. Which should be a universal age.
Well, I mean, you're an adult at 18, right? You're legally considered an adult.
You can leave home and move to France and no one can say jack crap
about
it.
That's right. What year was that again, Rach, for 21?
1984. 27 years ago in 1998, The Mask of Zorro was released, starring Antonio Banderas, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Anthony Hopkins. I remember when Zorro came out, we had like a toy sword with a sheath.
Yeah.
And of course, my brother would play with the sword. I got to use the sheath as my sword, but I would do the Z.
Yeah.
Because of Zorro.
That's so funny you say that. That, like, the crab flows downhill. And when you're the little kid, you get the sheath.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I'm pretty sure it was his sword.
Yeah.
And he was letting me use the sheath, but it was just like, yeah, I mean.
How often did Big Dave actually hurt you and then just be like, don't tell mom, don't tell dad?
Not often. No, not often.
Yeah.
Mm. Was Don't Tell Mom and Dad a big thing for you guys?
Huge.
Growing up, yeah.
Huge.
I was just relaying, I had a memory and I was talking to my brother about it. We went and saw the movie Small Soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
When I was like 8 and he was 13. And he could only go and see the movie if he took me with him, which he did not want to do. And I also couldn't go see a PG-13 movie because I was 8. So he lied to them and told them that it was PG. And my biggest memory of that movie is being in the car with him. And he's like, you don't say a word of this to mom and dad. They do not need to know that this was a PG-13 movie.
Oh, yeah. I used to. So my brother and sister were 11 and 14 years older than me. So they were out of the house by the time I was like 4. But my nieces were 6 and 8 years younger than me. So I grew up with them like little sisters. And just, oh my God, I would nunchuck the hell out of them and then be like, you can play pitcher tonight when we play baseball. It's like, okay. I was constantly making deals.
Yeah. See, when we were kids, my brother, he's 3 years younger. He was the aggressor. More often than not, he had a real bad temper, so he'd like punch me in the face. And then I'd get in trouble for hitting him back because I'd leave a bruise.
Yikes.
That's not fair.
Play this song when everyone dies.
When every individual dies, or yes. when everyone dies?
No, when every individual dies. Or when you announce it, like anytime you reference someone's death, you have to play this song.
Make it all feel a lot happier.
Yeah.
It's a happy sounding song.
Like, oh, well, okay. I can live with that. Wheels, why don't you give us a preview? Give us a preview, not just of the D-backs coming up, but of sort of the second half of the season and strength of schedule and all that kind of stuff.
So I saw a strength of schedule ranking. The Cardinals do not have a super difficult schedule the rest of the way. It's not one of the easiest ones, but it's not that far off. I think it's kind of like it's on the easier side yeah. for the rest of the way. So Arizona's been one of the probably the more disappointing teams in baseball this year. They were supposed to be a contender. A lot of people thought they were the second best team in the West behind the Dodgers, but they're three games under 500. They've lost a whole bunch of players to injuries. Like most of their starting rotation is down. Some of their best players in the lineup have missed a bunch of time here and there with injuries. Their all-star Suarez got hit in the hand during the all-star game.
Yeah, I saw that.
You know, they've had a pretty crappy run in terms of luck. Nobody's announced their full rotation for the weekend coming out. So the Cardinals, we know Pallante is going to pitch Friday, but that's all we know for the Cardinals. We don't know about Arizona. But this stretch before the trade deadline, which is July 31st, you've got four series. So you've got Arizona, they're three games under 500. You've got the Rockies, who are on pace to be the worst team in the history of Major League Baseball. Then you've got the Padres, who are good, but not as good as everybody thought they would be. You know, they're better than the Cardinals. I mean, let's be clear about that, but not by much. I think they're only like a game and a half better than the Cardinals. So that's a really important series, and that's four games, but it's here. Mm-hmm. It's at Busch Stadium. And then you play Miami three games, and the Marlins, even though they just had a really great run. I mean, they had a run where they won, I think, was it 10 or 11 games in a row? Like, they had their longest winning streak in franchise history. But even after all of that, they're still seven games under 500.
Yikes.
Like, that's a team that you should be able to beat. So you've got three series that you will be expected to win. And then you've got the Padres series, which is a four-game series, and you probably need to split that. But this is all that exists before the trade deadline. So the trade deadline is the day after the Marlins series ends on an mm-hmm. off day. I don't know if they're going to take it all the way down to the wire on that, you know, like, you know, which direction they're going to go. But these are the series. These are the games that are going to kind of that are going to dictate direction.
So are guys like Mozeliak having discussions now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so yeah. It's not like everyone's waiting till the last few days.
No, what you're waiting for in the last few days is just picking a direction and yeah. then deciding whether or not the costs are worth whatever, or the return is worth whatever you yeah. have to
well,
get
I guess
up.
What I meant is, are they having discussions with each other?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. They've all had, it, like, so I'm sure every team does it. I'm sure what, you know, if you're in Mo's position, because some teams know exactly what they are, right? Dodgers know their buyers, Rockies know their sellers, you know, that kind of thing. But most of baseball is in the middle, which means they're probably pursuing both tracks.
Yeah.
Well, if we decide to sell, who are the teams that would be interested in those guys? What are they interested in giving up? So you're going to be gauging both things at the same time, which is why you don't typically see a lot of deals between now and the deadline, because there are too many teams that are still kind of sitting on the fence trying to figure out which way they want to go. And if you go on a hot streak and you win, I don't know, what is this? You've got 13 games before that. If you go 10-3, well, that puts you in a position where you're definitely not selling and you're either holding or buying. And even if the Cardinals buy, I think people should set their expectations correctly. Like, even if they're buying, I would imagine it's incremental buying. It's not going to be a blockbuster. It's not going to be, I wouldn't expect it to be anything huge.
Do you foresee a time in the foreseeable future, who knows what the Cardinals will be in 30 or 40 years, but in the foreseeable future where we are competing for the top guys, where we're in the Juan Soto chase, or we're in an Ohtani chase, or maybe even a guy that's $300 million?
For the top end on the salary spectrum, no. I would see them more likely. Let's say you develop another Albert Pujols. I think it would be more likely that you would sign that player to a long-term extension in advance of them hitting free agency and paying them top dollar. That's more likely than getting out in the bidding marketplace and outbidding the big boys. Now, this is further out, but this is, to answer your question, I think a lot of it depends on what happens in collective bargaining, right? So the CBA's up after next year. And I'm a little worried this time. I'm a little worried that the owners are itching for a fight. I think my operating theory, and this is not based on any conversations with anybody, just observing how owners and how I act and how the commissioner of baseball is talking. They seem to be itching for a fight to get a salary cap. And I think my read on it is this is probably a time where the political vibe of the country might give you the sway to do it, to pick the fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is, I could see this becoming a labor dispute and then the president saying, ah, the players, they make a lot of money. They should get back to work or whatever. I can see the pressure working for owners and against players in the environment that we're in right now. I don't think a cap is a good idea, but here's why I'm getting the roundabout way to answering your question. If a system were to come in with a salary cap and a salary floor and more extensive revenue sharing, where the gap between St. Louis and New York is much smaller, then yes, I could see them in those conversations, because then most teams would be in those conversations. And if I'm going to editorialize a little bit on this, the idea that a salary cap solves anything is nonsense. It does nothing. Unless revenue sharing levels the playing field. And right now it doesn't. Right now they do revenue share, but it doesn't bring the lower end teams anywhere near the top teams. So if you have a cap at $300 million and a floor at $150 million, that still means the top teams are spending twice what the bottom teams would be. So if you look at the capped leagues, NFL, NBA, NHL, the floor is like 80% of the cap. Not 50%. And it's because they all have way more extensive revenue sharing. The NFL flat out shares everything, with some minor exceptions, like you don't have to share signage at your stadium or things like that. But you're sharing TV, you're sharing literally everything else pretty much right down the middle. So most teams have about the same amount of money to spend. Unless you're doing that, salary caps don't work. They don't matter. They don't do anything. They don't enhance competitive balance, and even in those leagues, it doesn't make it any more competitive. Major League Baseball has more different champions and more different playoff teams than any of those sports. So the only benefit to a salary cap system is that owners control costs. That's it. That's the only benefit. That doesn't benefit me as a baseball fan, which is why I don't care about it. I don't think it makes any sense. But if you're going to do the flat out, we're gonna share revenue equally with everybody. Well, then sure, let's go ahead. We can do a cap and a floor if we're going to do that.
What if I told you with the Cardinals that next year we're going to have J.J. Weatherholt, Liam Doyle, and McGreevy with the big club, that we're going to trade Helsley and Newt, and we're going to get a number two?
I can see any of those things but getting the number two.
You don't think that we have the juice to do that?
I'm not sure that player exists in free agency.
Okay.
And if he does, he's going to be more expensive than you want him to be.
Okay.
You could maybe trade for that guy. And I don't think that trading Helsley, first of all, if you're trading Helsley, you got to do it in the next 2 weeks.
Right.
If you don't, he's a free agent at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And I do think there's a chance that they'll trade someone like Lars Nubar. But they have to move some of those guys.
And I would hate to see Lars leave because I like him and I like Yellen Newt. But,
Yeah, I mean, you have a limited number of guys you can move.
We have a glut.
Right? I mean, you're not moving Mason Wynn unless some kind of godfather deal comes through that you don't expect, right? Because there are trades where you just can't turn them down. But nobody's really going to do that. You're not moving him. You're not going to be moving Contreras because you need him. You're not moving Herrera. You know, like if you look around the lineup, it's going to come from that second base, third base, left field mix. So for those positions, because if Herrera is the DH, those positions, you have to get Alec Burleson. You got to get Lars Nootbaar. You got to get Brendan Donovan. You got to get Nolan Gorman. You got to get Nolan Arenado. So you got five guys for three positions. That's the group that you have to move out. And it's, you're not going to get to move Arenado unless you're eating almost all of the money, because he's getting worse. His offense is getting worse. His defense is still great, but it's not what it used to be. And it's just age. That's all it is. It's not like he tries as hard as anybody. He works his butt off. It's not about anything other than you're just getting older and everybody's aging curve is different. But it's now a third straight year of offensive decline, and nobody's going to say, oh, sure, we'll pay him half of that salary. They won't want that. You're going to have to pay more of that. So he is the guy that I almost, you think you have to expect to be here next year. Hmm. And if that's the case, then it means you got to move a couple of those other guys.
Yeah.
And do you want to move Donovan? I mean, you'd get a great trade for him. You'd get a lot for him. And this is what we talked a little bit about yesterday. Nate and I talked about this, and then Matt and I, Paulie and I have talked about it in the past. Do you make the trades just to move the players you'd prefer to clear out of the way? Or do you make the trade on what gets you the most in return?
See, I don't think we can get back much better than Brendan Donovan.
No, he's probably your most valuable trade asset right now. I think Gorman has a lot of value because he's young, he's cost-controlled, and he's got power. But can you afford to give it up? Can you afford to give up possible 30 home run power? Where else do you have it? Contreras doesn't hit 30 homers a year. Herrera's never done it, and maybe he will, but I don't know that he's a 30 homer guy. Arenado's not that guy anymore. Wynn's not that guy. Scott's not that guy. Jordan Walker hasn't figured out how to hit in the major leagues. Lars Nootbaar's not a 30 homer guy. Pedro Páez. So if you trade the one guy on the roster that has shown he can hit 30 home runs in the big leagues, where's your power? Unless Walker figures it out, but he hasn't, and he's not figuring it out at Double A right now. He stinks at Double A.
Do you see Weatherholt as that?
He's not a 30 homer guy, I don't think. I mean, could I picture him that 5 years from now? Maybe. That's not really his game. His game is more Donovan with more power than Donovan, right? So maybe he's more like the power of, and I mean just like home run numbers, not exit velos or whatever, but like the home run numbers you will see from like Wilson Contreras, 20 to 25, I think that's what he's going to probably be. He's a great hitter. Like a great hitter, but he's not a pure home run hitter, and he's not a really big guy.
Yeah.
So he doesn't answer that part of the equation. So if you want home run power, you got to find a spot for Gorman. And if you have a spot for him, that means, and Burleson has some power, but again, Burleson's not a 30 homer guy either. He never was in the minors, and he's more of a 20 to 25, which again is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But what I'm saying is, if you're trading Gorman, you're taking away one of the few guys on the major league team that can actually hit the ball over the fence with some regularity, and that matters in 2025. And then I ask the question about this. Here's what we don't know. Are they going to remain as attached to defense under Chaim Bloom as they are under John Mozeliak? Because right now you have a center fielder that can't hit, you have a shortstop that's not hitting at all, you've got a third baseman that doesn't hit, and you've got a catcher that doesn't hit. So you got four spots in your lineup right now that do not hit above average. They're below average offensive producers. Is that sustainable?
Welcome back, DGS 251. Happy Thursday. I am taking the day off tomorrow. I have something I need to do. I'll be back on Monday, though. Everyone's going to take good care of you. You guys see that Eddie Bauer is changing their logo and why?
No.
What's going on?
Because it is written in cursive, and the kids can't read it. So they've made it big, blocky print letters.
Oh. You know, Eddie Bauer's all about the kids.
Yeah.
All I hear is
those kids love that Eddie Bauer.
Gen Z is going, man, I want some of that, but I can't pronounce it.
Only Tom of Bahama is more popular with the little kids.
All the Gen Zs are like, I love your vest. Where'd you get it? And then they're, I have no idea.
That's the first time anyone called me old was about 10 years ago. We were in Florida, and we loved to go in Naples, and we loved to go eat at the Tommy Bahama restaurant. And I would always go look around at clothes, and Phoebe's like, you're old. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, you love everything at Tommy Bahama. And I'm like, yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah,
I do. Like, if I lived down there, I'd wear nothing but that stupid, embarrassing crap.
Why is it embarrassing?
I don't know. Just because it's very like Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little weird if you're not living in a tropical environment.
Yeah. The oldest human footprints ever found have been found in Saudi Arabia, where they did not expect them. And they're 115,000 years old.
Yee.
And it's proof positive, not just carbon-14 dating, but the sediment that they're in is a watering hole, and it's surrounded by animals from that era.
That's cool.
Isn't that cool? 115,000 years ago, modern humans just like us. And isn't it amazing that in just the past 2,000 years what we've done, and in the past 200 years what we've done? I mean, Thomas Jefferson had no idea that dinosaurs existed. And here we are on Mars. It's nuts, right?
Pretty cool.
Pretty crazy. Bet we can't read cursive.
You got to wonder what we don't know about, you know?
Absolutely. Do you guys hear the Scottie Scheffler stuff?
I did.
No.
I didn't really pay a lot of attention to it, but I did.
He's an interesting guy. So he's the number one golfer now, and he was doing a press conference, and he's like, look, it's not that I don't care if I win the British Open, but it doesn't fulfill me. And to become the number one golfer in the world didn't fulfill me. And winning championships, why do I want another championship? I don't know. Does it fulfill me on the deepest levels? No, it doesn't. It was quite an interesting interview.
I'm glad that he's able to have that kind of self-reflection, you know, because you wonder when someone becomes like that elite of an athlete. I hate to compare it to the billionaire thing because they're very different. But like, at what point do you become just happy with your accomplishments and stop? I think it's admirable that he kind of seems to be leaning that direction as far as like, you know, just prioritizing different things other than just his sport. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting question, and there's nothing wrong with being that way, but I know a lot of older school people hated it. Because if your drive is, so basically what a lot of people would argue, I don't have a real good take because I'm torn on it. I do think you have to have balance, but if you're not driven to be successful, then are you just doing it because you're getting paid a lot of money? And by the way, not an invalid reason to do something.